Greetings and welcome to another RBW Wealth Wisdom podcast. We're delighted today to welcome Christina Hooper, Chief Global Strategist at Invesco and one of the economists and advisors on whom we rely very heavily for valuable input. It is our great pleasure to welcome you, Christina, and we look forward to having you share some of your wisdom with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Selwyn.
I wanted to start the conversation by maybe having you give us a kind of a macro overview of where we stand today amidst market turbulence, political strife and chaos, elections impending. Can you kind of give us the helicopter view of how you see things?
Sure. Well, actually, my base case is that the economy continues to do quite well. What we've seen this year is growth that will likely by the end of the year globally be about 3.7%. Of course, that means a pretty significant divergence between advancing economies, the developed economies versus emerging economies. But it is certainly an environment where they're all participating in growth. It's just more divergence there. And of course, risks are growing in this environment. They are not my base case, but we do have to recognize that there's this potential for some elements of geopolitical risk to tamp down economic growth. And actually, it's one geopolitical risk in particular. It's trade. Tariffs could impact economic growth. They could have an impact on earnings. So we have to recognize that. Again, it's a relatively short-term phenomenon. Hopefully, the trade situation will improve relatively quickly. The other issue is monetary policy. We're unwinding very, very accommodative monetary policy right now in the U.S. It's been something of an experiment, what we've done over the last decade. And so unwinding it is a bit of an experiment. But really, what we're doing is normalizing monetary policy, and that's going to normalize capital markets. The problem is many investors don't remember what it was like before the crisis. And so they don't remember that the kind of volatility we're returning to is actually more normal than the environment we've been in for the last decade. So those are risks to the scenario, but I think at the end of the day, what they're likely to do is just contribute to volatility going forward. We'll still see economic growth that's strong globally, and we'll still see opportunities created for investors. We'll still see capital appreciation, although in the shorter term, it might get tamped down a bit because of the risks.
Thank you. And in terms of the impending elections, any thoughts on what they might do to stock market prices and the economic political environment?
Sure. So I'm not too worried about midterms, no matter what the outcome is. I do think that while investors are worried that we could see the House go Democratic, I don't think that's going to be a significant issue, really for two reasons. The first is that so much of the administration's agenda that we've gotten so far has been very positive for growth. But the other items on the agenda, like trade, that we've seen more recently, aren't as positive for growth. So you could see an environment where Congress actually tries to take back some of its powers with regard to trade. Keep in mind that the Constitution gives Congress the power to levy tariffs. And really, since the 30s, Congress has been giving up that power to the executive branch. Ironically, President Roosevelt convinced Congress that it had made a mistake with Smoot-Hawley, and he could do a better job. And that was really the start of eight decades of giving up power over tariffs to the executive branch. So you could see Congress trying to take back some powers. That really wouldn't be a bad thing, because they're probably less direct and aggressive ways to improve the trade environment. The other positive that could come if the House flips Democratic is you could see a greater likelihood of an infrastructure spending bill. Infrastructure has a great multiplier effect for the economy, so that could be a real positive. So I think either way, we're going to either get a House and Senate that are Republican, and we are likely to get some small set of tax cuts, which would be a positive, or we have a House that goes Democratic, and hopefully we have the potential for infrastructure spending and maybe some curtailing of trade powers.
Christina, tell me a little bit about interest rates, where you see them, this concept of an inverted yield curve, what it is, how does that affect our investors and the economy?
Sure. Well, we get a lot of questions on the inverted yield curve, that idea that the spread between what is the 2-year rate and the 10-year rate closes into the point where, in fact, you see a 2-year that's higher than the 10-year. That's intended to indicate, and what investors read into it is that the prospects for the future are worse than the present, and in other words, we're likely to see a recession. And actually, an inverted yield curve historically has been rather predictive, but we have to stress that it doesn't cause a recession. It just tends to be an indicator that a recession may be coming.
Causation versus correlation.
Exactly. And quite frankly, we also have to realize that there's a pretty significant lag time between when a yield curve inverts and when a recession occurs. The average that we've seen over the last 7 recessions has been about 21 months. So it's not like you automatically see a yield curve and you run for the gates. This is an environment also where what's altering yields is balance sheet normalization. So we're seeing, the kind of experimental monetary policy we've experienced over the last decade has skewed fixed income. And so it's not as easy to say this is signaling what we've seen it signal in the past, because the Fed is operating a few different levers at the same time. It's raising rates at the same time that it's normalizing the balance sheet, and it can have, sort of a wild, wacky kind of impact. Now, in terms of rates themselves, I wouldn't expect the Fed to raise rates as many times as most expect. I'm still of the opinion that the Fed may not raise rates a fourth time this year, although I'm in the minority on that. I also think the Fed may hit the pause button next year, that we might see maybe 2 rate hikes and then the Fed hits the pause button. Because in this environment, while we've gotten good growth, we can't say that there's an immediate need for the Fed to raise rates until inflation really rears its ugly head in a more significant way than anything we've seen thus far. It's a delicate balancing act, because we know that the Fed needs dry powder for the next crisis, but at the same time, it doesn't want to choke off economic growth. I'm hoping that it errs on the side of caution. I think that's what a Yellen FOMC would do. My expectation is that we could see the FOMC start to pull back next year and question more whether it is choking off or impacting negatively on economic growth.
You know, speaking of rates, from interest rates to now tax rates, one of the things I thought was interesting was potentially talking about the impact on corporate profits. And then also second, one of the things that I found really interesting is the fact that the best might have yet to come. So can you describe a little bit more about that?
Sure. So, this tax reform package was incredibly comprehensive. We were able to see a lowering of household tax rates, corporate tax rates, and a repatriation tax holiday. But I would argue the really very significant impact to the economy came from corporate tax cuts. It's already improved earnings, and that's likely to continue. And what's really interesting is if you look at the Congressional Budget Office's projections for the next decade, it expects the greatest impact on GDP to come from tax cuts in 2021 and 2022. So we haven't even seen the best yet. The good news is that companies are certainly aware of the permanence of the tax cuts, believe that we are much more competitive today than we were 2 years ago because the corporate tax rate was lowered so much, and they're spending accordingly. What's interesting about the tax reform package is it was well written. It incentivized business investment. And so we're certainly seeing an improvement in business investment, not as much as I'd like to see, but we're moving in that direction. And so without any other tax cuts, just the nature of this tax reform package is one that I would view as a gift that keeps on giving for years to come.
If you want to be a pessimist about this, Christina, how do you respond to the pessimist who asks, how is this different than Japan over the last few decades?
Well, there are certainly some differences between us and Japan, and I would argue there are some ways I don't think it's a bad thing to be like Japan. I think our greatest similarity with Japan is demographically. Certainly not nearly as bad as Japan, but we could be at some point in a situation like Japan if our population lives a very long time. I mean, just an interesting anecdote. the Japanese government used to give out, for anyone who turned 100 who was a Japanese citizen, you would get a sterling silver platter. Well, in about 2014, they announced they had ended that program. And they didn't even go to silver plated. They just ended it because too many people were turning 100.
Wow.
It's a wonderful problem to have, but it's a problem for the government. And so we could get to that point, especially if we were to curtail immigration a lot in the U.S. Ironically, I was just in Tokyo last week, and I was talking a lot with some government officials about how they're changing their immigration policies, and they've opened up guest worker visas. Because they need more able-bodied workers because of the demographic situation. So actually, Japan recognizes some of the issues it faces, but its biggest one is debt. Right now, Japanese government debt is about 240% of GDP. That's a lot of debt to service. Now, the good news is there's no real reason why they need to raise rates, so they can service it, but it would be problematic if they needed to raise rates.
How does that compare with our GDP versus debt?
So we're at about 105% gross debt to GDP, so we're certainly in much better shape. The problem is that our debt is projected to grow, and so we're going to need to find ways to continue to grow the economy, increase tax revenues, or somehow lower spending. So it's not going to be easy. Luckily, it's not an issue that affects us today, but it is one that we'll probably have to come to terms with in the next decade.
Terrific. By the way, I heard that in Japan now they sell more adult diapers than children's diapers.
That is absolutely correct.
Which is quite scary, and if we're heading in that direction, that's not a great thought.
No.
Onto the subject at hand. What is your outlook for inflation over the short and intermediate term?
So my outlook for inflation right now is quite benign. I would expect that it stays a little below 2%. Now, having said that, I do think there are two potential catalysts that could drive up inflation that I'm following closely. One, of course, is wage growth. This is a great job market. And at a certain point, I expect wage growth to pick up. But we're nowhere near where we should be given where we are in our economic expansion. We should probably be at about 3.5% wage growth, and we're at about 2.8% annualized wage growth. So we're nowhere near where I would start to worry that that creates inflation. But if that goes up soon, then I might change my outlook. The other issue, of course, is tariffs and its impact on input costs. Its impact that could be passed on to consumers, for example. We're just going to want to follow that closely. We haven't seen that show up in the data in any material way, but it could happen in the future. And so that's just something to watch as one of our risk factors.
Thank you. And outlook for the economy, for the stock market, if we can just ask you to take out the proverbial crystal ball. What are you seeing for 2019, and if you were a betting woman, which I assume you're not, what would you expect to put your money on for the S&P 500 close at the end of 2019?
Well, the crystal ball is a bit cloudy right now, just because we have to get through midterms. But having said that, I would expect relatively a lot of volatility. So it's going to be a lot of work to get to the end of the year, but that the stock market will be in positive territory, that we'll probably see 2019 as a tepid year for stocks, but a positive year. So I would say, mid to high single digits. Of course, dividends will add to total return, but in terms of just price appreciation, probably most likely the high single digits. Now, of course, there's a lot that could change that, both to the upside and to the downside. So much really will be dictated in terms of what we see shape up with midterms.
Thank you so much. Thank you on behalf of Stephen So, Jonathan Gerber, and myself, and all of our RVW team. We thank you so much. You're a wealth of information. You're a great teacher. You have a depth of understanding and a clarity of vision. And we thank you for sharing that with us and our listeners. Thank you.
This podcast is not intended to constitute investment, legal, or tax advice. The ideas and strategies expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those recommended or implemented by RVW Wealth. Please consult and rely exclusively on your professional advisors.